When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chick lit that made us who we are. My name is Karen O'Donoghue and I'm an author, a journalist and a Patsy Cline times two enthusiast. Joining me is podcaster and founding member of the Licorice Comfits, Alan McGuire. Today we're talking about Nick Hornby's High Fidelity. Hi.
Hello.
What are your top five reasons for choosing this book?
Oh my God. Okay. I have read it more than any other non-Terry Pratchett book, I think.
Okay.
So it's the most appropriate book to pick for this. Mm-hmm. It's very funny. Mm. It's about relationships. Mm. It is...
Got two more left.
Two more left. It is about men in a way that men can learn from.
Oh, in a way excellent
that
point.
Most other books aren't, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's got a great soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and a real, I'm very similar to you in the sense that I've read this book more than any other book. Mm. I think I picked it up when I was about 17. And there was a point in my life where this book, the High Fidelity, was both my favorite album, film, and book. It was a real simple time for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you come to film or book first?
Film first. It was one of the first films me and my wife ever watched together when we were, it came out in 2000, so... Yeah, we were like 16, 17, I think, when we saw that.
Yeah.
We started going out in 2001.
It's kind of the perfect date movie in many ways.
It kind of is, but I was thinking, because I've always thought that I learned how to be in like an adult relationship from not being, like running away from what Rob is. Mm. But I'm also wondering if maybe it got into my head too early as a 16-year-old to take in that you should stick with the relationship you have no matter what. I love my wife and I'm very, very happy that I think everything has worked out 18 years later.
Yeah.
18 years today, actually, as a recording.
18 years today?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God, congratulations.
Thank you.
For doing what Rob could never do.
Exactly. But yeah, so that's, I think it's, yeah, it's a good day. It is a good day movie. It's,
yeah.
Because it's funny and about relationships, but not in a way that would make you awkward on a first date, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's also a nice one to rewatch with your partner, especially when you're younger and you don't have a lot of the dialogue that you need to mm-hmm. have a relationship. And you can kind of be like, is this like in High Fidelity when, am I Sarah Kendrew? So I'm going to do a quick plot summary. Rob is a 30-something record shop owner and pop music fanatic who has just been dumped by his long-term girlfriend, Laura. Perplexed as to why his relationships keep going so badly wrong, he decides to track down his five most memorable ex-girlfriends to find out why he is destined to be alone. And the five are Alison Ashworth, Penny Hardwick, Jackie Allen, Charlie Nicholson, and Sarah Kendrew. Do you see your name on that list, Laura? I love how this book starts. I think it's an incredibly smart way to begin a book. And it's got this little prologue where he just says, my top five desert island breakups are this, and he names those five women. Mm-hmm. And then he says, do you see your name on that list, Laura? And he goes into this explanation of, you know, maybe if you'd gotten to me earlier when skins were thinner and hopes were higher, you could have made a dent, but too bad, no cigar kind of thing. And it's such a brilliant summation of the rawness and also the jadedness that people feel after a certain age when they're having another breakup, you know?
This is the first time I've read and watched it since I was actually his age. So I was always like 10 years younger than him at least.
Really. You're like exactly his age.
By the time this comes out, I'll be exactly his age. I'm 34 now, I'll be 35 when this comes out.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's really exciting. I'm a bit like, and I think I'm probably also the worst person to talk about relationships because I've had one. And I have no exes.
So you didn't even have an Alison Ashworth. You didn't even have like someone you kissed when you were 12 and then went off with Kevin Bannister.
No, I had one girlfriend for 2 weeks and we never actually got around to kissing. But we got each other Christmas presents. Like, Caroline's literally the fifth and last person I've ever kissed.
Aww.
So it's... I'm a terrible relationships advice person in general.
Because your advice is always, you should marry them.
Yeah, or it's, if it was Caroline, here's what you would do. You would put on some true crime and that kind of thing. But yeah, so I think like as a 35-year-old now, I'm kind of like... I feel like Rob feels younger in a way. I think possibly because I am so like settled down and stuff, he reacts to things in quite a destructive way that I would have, maybe most men haven't grounded that. I don't know. Maybe I even haven't grounded it. Maybe I just haven't been confronted with that situation, so I don't know.
He's quite knowingly childish about things.
Yes. I think he gets more of an awareness of that as it goes on. He is quite the douchebag at the start.
I think he's a douchebag throughout.
Well, yeah.
But also, it's one of those things, and one of my favorite, I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but one of my favorite parts of the book, I'll actually skip to it. Yeah, we're on this journey with Rob, this whole book of he's left Laura and he slowly realizes that he doesn't feel okay about breaking up with Laura, that she has gotten to him, that she has gotten under his skin. And we're on this journey with him, and he's neurotic, but he's that kind of Woody Allen neurotic that as a 90s audience, definitely, you grow to love. I think now the parlance is like, ugh, neurotic men, like, get over it or whatever. But I think he was such a endearing hero because his world he lives in is so attractive, like the kind of the grunginess of that shop. And
I've been in that shop.
I
know that shop.
I love that shop.
It's BPM Records in Waterford, or Plugged in Cork.
I was about to say Plugged in Cork. And it definitely gave me an early romance for record shops. But then we find out on page 80, which for a relatively slim book is quite far in, why actually they broke up. So people will remember this in the film as the moment when Joan Cusack walks into the shop and she goes, "Hi, Rob, you fucking asshole." So this is what comes just after that. I do not know what precisely Laura said, but she would have revealed at least two, maybe even all four, of the following pieces of information. One, that I slept with somebody else while she was pregnant. Two, that my affair contributed directly to her terminating the pregnancy. Three, that after her abortion, I borrowed a large sum of money from her and have not as of yet repaid any of it. Four, that shortly before she left, I told her I wasn't happy in the relationship and that I was kind of, sort of, maybe looking out for someone else. Did I say and do these things? Yes, I did. Are there any mitigating circumstances? Not really, unless any circumstances, in other words, context, could be regarded as mitigating. And before you judge, although you have probably already done so, go away and write down the worst four things that you have done to your partner, even if, especially if, your partner does not know about them. Don't dress these things up or try to explain them. Just write them down in a list in the plainest language possible. Finished? Okay, so who's the arsehole now? And what's lovely about that is that he goes another 10 pages before he even explains the context for any of those terrible things. Mm-hmm. And it's just this brilliant look into the how brutal relationships are, you know?
Yeah, I mean, because if you spend a lot of time with someone, you will, in a variety of ways, accidentally just hurt them. It's just, I'm an idiot. So it just happens. You can't help it. I mean, obviously those ones have a lot more intent behind them than forgetting to put out the rubbish or whatever. But when I read that bit the other day, I was like, I'm not going to write down those things. I'm not even going to try to confront that.
I've read that paragraph so many times in the last 10 years and I have not as of yet done any of them.
They cut that bit, like, have all of that verbatim except for that last bit in the film as well. Which is interesting that they cut that bit out.
Yeah.
Because I think it would just take everybody out of the film. Because everybody would be going, oh God, what have I done?
Whereas
the book, you can sit with it for a little while, but with a film, you can't. So they have to cut that out.
Right. And the film is one of those films where he talks with the camera, so it could be there. And I think it's funny how often we've both read it and how neither of us done it. And I have done some terrible things in relationships, but all of which I give context to. Like, oh, well, he was this, he was that, he was toxic, he was whatever. But like, does that explain cheating on three separate people? I think that's the sort of core of the book, is that it is quite a chick-litty commercial book, but it's really brutal.
Yeah.
It's really brutal.
I want to talk about that a bit, because it never occurred to me that it was chick-lit until the very first episode of Sentimental Garbage, when you mentioned Nick Hornby.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I guess it is, I suppose. Yeah. Because I haven't read much of what gets covered on Sentimental Garbage, really. I've started reading it now based on the podcast.
What have you read? What do you like?
So I've read Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah.
I've read Americana.
Oh, great.
I have bought The Lost, what was it? The Last
Art of Human Secrets.
Secret. And, I've read Marion Keyes before as well, obviously, because hello, Marion. And I'm going to buy some Sophie Kinsella as well.
Oh, you would like that a lot.
I thought I might. Yeah. So, explain to me in what way it is. What does it have in common?
So, yeah, I think people will be confused as its inclusion. I think what's really interesting about Nick Hornby as a writer is, first of all, he writes in a way that has a lot in common with your Marion Keyes's or your Sophie Kinsella's, in that there is a kind of a jauntiness to the prose that hides, and a contemporariness as well. It's very contemporary. It's very like that thing of like name-checking celebrities, name-checking pop cultural things, naming real London locations. That's quite a trope of chick lit, I feel.
Yeah.
And so it's like this very approachable, breezy, jokey, humorous, endearing world that also is about these very deep relationship truths. And I also think that Nick Hornby, despite, I think it was called Dicklit when it came out, and it was this kind of, the conversation around him when he first emerged was that, oh, it's kind of what women are doing but for men. But I think it was always read by women in order to try and understand men.
Yeah, I think it's actually described like that. It's kind of like a heightened ordinariness. It's almost like a heightened ordinariness. It's like, it's how you, it's everybody wishes their interior monologue was like that witty and wise about everything, but about very ordinary things. Mm. Actually, not to blow smoke, but I think Jane in Promising Young Women is a lot like that as well, where she comes up with very wise, funny things all the time. Like the one thing, and I think it's something High Fidelity and your book have in common, it's like a very specific nugget from both, is the thing about, the good thing about being a couple, or sorry, the secret of being a good couple is it wanting the same holidays, which is a lot like, it's not what you like, it's what you're like, or the reverse, whichever one he get, like, you know, both of those.
It's not what you're like, it's what you like.
Yeah, which is the false one that eventually reneges on in the book.
Yeah.
Not in the film, but in the book he does, because remember she brings him...
at the very end of the book, first of all, thank you. And at the very end of the book, she brings him after Laura and Rob get back together. And I think this the time span of this book is about maybe 2 months long.
Yeah, it's 2 to 3 months, I would say. Yeah.
And she brings him to like some friends, some work friends of hers who don't have particularly great taste, but who are really sound.
Yeah.
And she just he's like surprised that he is even able to have a good time with people who don't like the same things as him.
Yeah, because she tricks him, because she lets them have a good evening first, and then when they go away, say, go look at the record collection.
Yeah.
And it's like multiple Simply Red albums. And stuff. Yeah. Which I would judge, like, I'm definitely a reformed snob.
You think so?
Oh, for sure. I'm glad I read High Fidelity when I did, and also Juliet Naked are two.
Yeah, they're very, very complimentary books.
Yeah, because they're both about. I was thinking that High Fidelity from Laura's perspective would be interesting, but I think that is kind of Juliet Naked.
Yeah.
Seeing Rob through someone else's eyes that has to live with him.
Yes.
Is kind of what Juliet Naked is.
So Juliet Naked, for the listeners, is kind of a later book that came out. Which is about a girl who is in a long-term relationship with a hyper fan of this false kind of Nick Drake character called Tucker Crowe. And basically the whole book is about his fandom and how exhausting and isolating and alienating it is, and how it becomes like a wall between the two of them. And then she fucks Tucker Crowe. And it's so rewarding.
It's a great, great book.
Yeah.
But in High Fidelity, like, I probably was lucky enough to not know those people, but just be the only one of them that I knew. So I think if that behavior had been reinforced by anybody, it might have taken longer to snap out of it.
Yeah.
But definitely, like, it took me a long time to, like, value pop music in any way.
Yeah.
Like, and still, if I have a choice, I'll listen to something with guitars in it, you know, I'm actually, like, cause all week I was listening to this High Fidelity playlist that's 8 hours of every song mentioned in the film and book.
Sure.
And I have never really been a lyrics person. But now that I have listened to what Rob listens to all the time, I can see why he's miserable.
Really?
I can see how that would get into your head, just not listen to nothing but those songs all the time.
Yeah.
Because it's all heartbreak and like mid-tempo and like Elvis Costello. And it's just, there's no pep anywhere, you know?
Yeah.
He has no pep in his life, really, I think.
Yeah.
It's just all about cataloging things rather than, he doesn't seem to necessarily enjoy things in the moment anyway.
Very much so. Like, there's even a part in the book where he's finally gets off with Maria DeSalle in one of the saddest and also most realistic one night stand scenes that you, and then they kind of, she's this folk singer and they go back to her apartment and they're having this like lovely chat and he feels very nervous and he suddenly gets up to leave because he can't, so he's just out of this 5-year relationship and then they have sex and it's fine and then they kind of, but he's worrying about it the entire time. like in a way that he's like, I don't even like sex really, can't we just skip this bit, and he can't sink into the moment. And then they have this sort of like 3 a.m. conversation that's, they're very frank about how neither of them particularly wants the other, and they're both just very wounded from their previous relationships.
Yeah, I mean, I've obviously have no experience whatsoever of that, unfortunately, for the podcast. But it feels true. I definitely, the bit where they're like getting to know each other and that where you spark with someone is definitely familiar. That felt very true, where you just, some people just, that conversation just flows, and some people you don't. And me especially, most conversations do not flow with me at all. So when you do...
What an interesting career you've picked.
I know. That's why I like to listen to people. That's why I have a co-host and why I host things, because I like to listen to people rather than actually do the talking, which is great to be on here now. But yeah, she's such an interesting... Marina Sala is so interesting because she's the American, you know?
Yeah.
The exoticness of just... But if you look... Have you looked up Susan Day pre-LA Law?
Yes, Googled I have.
She's like... No offense to her, but she's quite an ordinary looking woman. But the glamour of an American singer songwriter.
It's very Richard Curtis, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Oh, totally is actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Just wow, this American who just come in from nowhere and like shaking us all up and saying words like horny.
I love how like that's like the moment he becomes unattracted to her.
Yes.
Kind of in the book.
It's so British. It's so 90s British masculinity.
Oh yeah. He is like a paragon of British 90s masculinity, like where he says in the start, where he's describing himself and how like perfectly mediocre he is.
Yes.
And he's like, I'm feminist, but not like a radical feminist. And I like just, and like his five favorite films are like Scarface, Godfather 1 and 2, Goodfellas, and Reservoir Dogs. Like, all right, Rob.
Yeah.
I know your posters.
And he's delighted with himself because he's seen Love in the Time of the Cholera.
Yeah. Which I haven't read. So he has that on me.
He does have that on me too.
Yeah. But yeah, he's you know that where people always post on Twitter like, oh, the bar is so low for men and stuff?
Yeah.
Rob is kind of that one, like, couple of notches above the bar is so low for men kind of person.
He's really frank about it as well.
Yeah.
And there's this bit where he says, like, I have had sex with 17 women. Am I good looking? Am I rich? No, I'm none of these things. I just ask them questions.
Mm.
And I feel like I really hope that a whole generation of men saw that and was like, oh...
It definitely, because I mean, if you listen for even a minute to any woman ever, you know that they like it when you listen to them. So the fact that so many men don't do that means there's not even a tinge of listening going on.
Yeah.
You know?
The thing is, it's easy to slack Rob again because of that list that I read out of all the terrible things that he's done to Laura.
Yeah.
But it's like, and there are much worse things he does in the book that I really want to get to as well. But for some reason, it's really hard to throw him out.
Oh, you know? Because it's partly because he's surrounded by much worse men everywhere.
Yeah.
Like Barry and Dick and like his friends at his birthday party.
Yes.
Which is, if you have only seen the film or the book, is the grimmest scene in the book.
Tell us a bit more about
it. So he realizes it's his birthday, basically the day of his birthday, because he's so thrown out by everything. And he rents 3 videos from the shop, Terminator 2, Naked Gun 2.5, and RoboCop 2.
Oh my God.
And watches those with some crisps and some cans of beer. It's not craft beer then. It's like he had harp or something. Like.
Oh God.
And then he realized he should probably do something. And then he rings his parents and his parents are busy, which is very sad. And he eventually gets Marie LaSalle and her friend T-Bone and his much younger girlfriend and just two random men that he hasn't stayed in contact really.
Oh, and they're the most boring man in the world.
Yeah. One of them is into Marie LaSalle's music, so he's able to like convince him to come out.
Yeah.
And the other man is someone who I've experienced in real life, and is the most infuriating thing in the world. So nobody from work is going to listen to this. In work, I used to go to lunch with basically like my group, and it was all women and me and one other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever the women started talking about quotation women stuff.
Yeah.
And even if I was obviously listening to him and taking part in the conversation, he would just immediately turn and start talking to me about something else.
Right.
Always. And I was like...
What counted as women's stuff?
Basically anything that wasn't computer games or football, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So not even just like, you know, gynecological stuff. But like, no, like... did you see Sex and the City?
Yeah, like Fair City or something like that. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
The two city shows.
Yeah. A Tale of Two Cities, yeah. it was the worst of times, and it was also the worst of times. But yeah, and the guy, this guy in Five Deadly, was the same thing. Basically, whenever Ra's getting into a conversation, he'll go, do you remember The Prisoner? That was good, wasn't it? And then everybody will go,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then everybody's talking with The Prisoner instead. He's like, I was just talking. She was midpoint when you said that to me in my ear, you know? You can't do anything about it.
You can't do it. There's nothing you can do. We've all been there, regardless of gender, at that thing of like that person who is just like a glaring red flag for any social situation, not because they're particularly offensive, but because they're so like horribly boring and so unable to actually properly interact. And I'm sorry, I know people have like problems socially and stuff, but that thing where like they're just, their eyes are boring into you and they just want to keep like, they want to keep you laser focused just on them. And you're like, hey, we're all in a group. Let's, maybe we all talk about Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, remember this one? That was good too, wasn't it? Oh, it's so painful. That birthday party makes my hands sweat.
Yeah, I mean, the book Rob is a much sadder person, I think, than film Rob.
Yeah, because the film Rob is John Cusack and he's just so brimming with charisma that you're like, oh, of course, Catherine Zeta-Jones. And
I mean, it's impossible to read the book now without hearing it in his lines.
Yeah,
because there are just so many like iconic line readings. I don't know if because I've seen the film like 8 times, but like every single bit you can hear it. I knew what was coming when I watched the film last night. Every single bit.
You watched the film again last night?
Yeah, I hadn't watched it in years, so I wanted to see it because I'm having a Jack Black moment. So.
Oh, it's a great moment to have.
It's his moment.
His moment that you're manufacturing.
That I'm manufacturing, yeah.
I think that the time is ripe to rediscover Jack Black. Because I think there was a moment where people got kind of sick of him because he was doing like kind of kids' movies and stuff. And he was clearly getting paid too much money to be paid in, to be in really bad films.
Yeah.
But there was a real sweet spot where School of Rock, High Fidelity, other stuff.
Tenacious D, the star of Tenacious D. They brought an album last year, which apparently is a thing. And they paid like Vicar Street.
Yeah, they're still, they keep on keeping on. I just think there's something genuinely very warm about Jack Black. And Daniel Ortberg pointed out recently, he's like, I'm convinced Jack Black is a trans man because he's so delighted with his own masculinity. He's so delighted. He's like, ah, look at this. Oh,
he's
a beard.
Just, we talked about this on Juvenile on our School of Rock episode. He's just ridiculously charismatic.
Yeah.
It's just this infectious charisma that most people don't have the ability to tap into. It's like he's like tapped into like the universe's core of charisma somehow. He has like a special drill.
It's like going rooted up right through his feet from the ground.
Yeah, he's like a prism, a funnel for charisma or something. Yeah, but anyway, he's not in the book.
So, but his character Barry
yeah.
is a really interesting one, and there's one bit as well, and it's so it's such an incredible observation of a certain kind of man where the two kind of sad men who work in the sad shop with him are Dick and Barry, and Barry's super loud and Dick's very quiet, but like Dick finds a girlfriend and her name is Anna Moss, and Barry can't take the idea that like one of them is going to go off and find happiness, so he just starts to like torpedo at any opportunity. He's like, Anna Moss, is she covered in moss, is she green? It's like, and Rob's like, yeah, he does this with women's names. He tries to like make it like sordid or weird, and he just like gives them these weird nicknames, and then he tries to sort of take away their specialness.
Yeah,
which is this. I've never been a man in a group of men, but I definitely know that happens, and I've seen that happen of like these men who just can't take the happiness of other men and just will just torpedo it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, like if you even see like in a group chat, if a man like guessing here and based off stuff I've seen on Twitter of other men, but if a man accidentally like shows affection for his partner in the lad chat,
yeah,
it's like pounded upon.
Really,
you know? You can't really show enthusiasm for your relationships as a most men, you know.
Wow,
I think it's really
no wonder you hang out with chicks so much.
Yeah, I do. I'm not a good at being a man around men, really, but. Yeah, Barry is definitely a real person.
Yeah.
He is many, many real people. Like, he's a gatekeeper.
Yeah.
Which Dick is a little bit as well. Dick is, I guess it's, they're kind of three different types of, like, toxic man. Rob is, like, the one you only realize a little bit later was kind of being a bit shitty.
Yeah.
Barry is outright, like, a gatekeeper controlling Dick.
Yeah.
And then Dick is the super quiet guy, but there's a bit in the book where Anna says, or he mentioned Anna likes prefab sprout.
Yeah.
And Dick says, but she kind of realizes now why she shouldn't, which is, ugh.
I know. It's such a throwaway line.
How dare you, Dick?
How dare you? Yeah, and it's just, It is that thing. And I think perhaps when Hornby wrote that, he just was like a throwaway line of like, haha, a certain kind of guy who can't take his girlfriend not liking a good band. But I think reading it as a woman who's dated a lot of men, you're just like, oh, I know that guy who just like won't, just kind of can't take the idea of someone not being exactly like him, so we'll just like softly, softly mold and manipulate, and then sooner or later the woman realizes she's been in this relationship with this turd for 5 years and she's like, what? How? Why? So I want to talk about the girlfriends, because there are, as much as this book is really good at being men looking at other men, what makes it almost frightening as a woman is like how, because you're always led to believe that when you're a woman dating men, that they kind of don't have that much subtlety, you know what I mean? And like, it's like they're playing chess, but you're playing 3D chess, you know? And everything's made of glass. And like, you see every level and they're just like, duh. Like, in terms of emotional stuff. And then once Rob starts calling up all of his ex-girlfriends, which doesn't happen until like page 130, which is weird considering it's the crux of the book. He starts going on these little kind of dates and meetings with them, trying to figure out like what went wrong, what's wrong with him that these women keep leaving him. And he, the way he sees them is so, so razor precise in a way that's almost like slightly cruel. Like the one that to me is Sarah Kendrew is one that I find really interesting. Because so Sarah Kendrew in his list of exes is the one who, when they were 27, they were both heartbroken, or in their mid-20s, they were both heartbroken, and they neither of them were particularly attracted to one another, but they decided to sort of pool their collective misery and just share a bed with each other or whatever, and they end up doing that for a few years. And he says this thing which I think about a lot when I see relationships that I don't think make sense, which is that, you know, we could never fill a room together, you know, when it was just us.
That line is it's a killer, isn't it?
It's a killer.
It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you immediately start thinking about yourself.
Completely.
You're like, I think we do.
Yeah.
Because it's impossible how, like, because you've been in a couple for a long time as well.
Yeah.
And it's, you do wonder how you look to outside people. Because it reminds me as well of that line from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yeah.
About Are We the Dining Dead? About couples in restaurants who don't talk to each other.
Wow.
You know, it's.
Oh, that's a line.
Isn't it? It's you really wonder.
Do you ever have that moment where, say, you're on holidays with Carol Ann, and say you've been on holidays for like 5 days, and like you're having one of those things where you're in the restaurant, you're kind of tired from the sun, and you're sort of like don't have that much to say because there's been no news because you've been with each other for 5 days, and you really kind of have nothing to say to them, and it's not like you're unhappy, you're just perfectly fine to just look at your phone for a bit until the bread comes, and then you kind of are suddenly super anxious and aware that people are looking at you and that you're one of those couples that other people look at like, God, how sad. And then I feel, and this happens with Sarah in the book, with Sarah Kendrew, where they said whenever they're around people who, they would purposely seek out people who were meeker and more introverted than them, and when they were around them their voices would get higher and louder and they would pretend to be really boisterous, and then as soon as they left those situations they would just go back to being these people who again couldn't fill a room together. And you do that, and I do that in that restaurant situation. I know you're like slightly more introverted than me and I tend to like speak way too much and too loud, but I do this thing where I'm like, God, what a wonderful time we're having, and Kevin's like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, what am I doing? I find that if in like a group dynamic situation where the loudest person is suddenly not there, I find myself getting louder.
Yeah.
But I don't just do it naturally. I do it naturally. It's an unconscious thing. Where, I remember like in our school group, there was like the one super charismatic guy who was like the head of the group.
Yeah.
Kind of the Charlie of the group, I would say. And if he wasn't there, I would find myself taking into that role a bit more and talking a bit more. But then as soon as he was back, I'd be like, I am the sidekick again, you know?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's, again, it's like impossible to know. Because, you know, like, I wonder how Rob and Sarah's friends saw them during that time, if they knew. Because I remember, like, me and Carol always thought we were quite, like, a quite boring couple. But then her roommate at the time said, like, was, like, intimidated by how cool we were. We were like, sorry, what? That we were like the cool couple to some people. And I was like, what's the cool couple?
So what's really interesting about the book structure is that in the preface, we get all the stories of these women as Rob knew them. So, you know, Sarah was, and it's, and I always remember this description, primary school teacher with brown hair, nice eyes, and looked like she always needed to go to the hairdresser.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh no. Oh no, it's too accurate. And you know, Alison Ashworth, who's, you know, 11 when they meet, or whatever. Charlie, who's this glamorous university student who's like into art and is kind of the first sort of inverted commas cool girl he ever meets.
Yeah.
And yeah, all these girls that he knows. And then we meet them towards the end of the book as the adults they are now. And Sarah is just like clearly quite depressed, and he kind of takes her out for a pizza, and it's kind of clearly the first time she's been out on anything that resembles a date in a long time.
Yeah.
And he says something like, and we both of us are too like liberal and enlightened to think that being single in your late 30s is the worst thing in the world, but it's hard to convince yourself when you wake up at Saturday morning and it's 10 hours until you have your next conversation. And it's like, again, it's a brutal book. And he kind of has this moment where he's like, I could have sex here, but I know it'll be the kind of sex where like, it'll be the kind of sex where the flat is sad and small and the cat will jump on, and it'll be, and he kind of describes it. And he's like, he's basically already had the sex by the time he's processed it in his head, and then he just leaves and he never sees her again. And we kind of get the sense like, oh, that woman could really end up anywhere. You know, she could end up selling jewelry on Etsy or having a mental breakdown.
Yeah, like she could end up with, like, joining the salsa club and finding the love of her life. It's very up in the air. Have you ever watched the Seven Up series?
The drink? You
know, the one where like they interviewed these like a load of 7-year-olds in like 1953, and they come back to them every 7 years.
Oh, I've heard of this. Yeah,
yeah, that's kind of what this is like.
Yes, it is like that.
Where you come back and you go, because sometimes you come back to that show and some of them are in really, really bad places, and you come back in 7 years later and they're doing much better.
Yeah,
and it's just, but they're. He's only seen these snapshots of these people. This is obviously a low point for Sarah.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not necessarily the entirety of her life. But no. That's all Rob's ever going to know over, because he's never going to see her again.
Yeah.
You know, and it's weird the way you kind of frame people like that.
And that's supposed to kind of, even though it's a really brutal and quite mean-spirited book in many ways, that is hidden behind a quite jolly, like, exterior. It is a kind of fantasy element of, we all sort of wish we could see. I mean, you don't, obviously, because you know how your girlfriend's doing. Yeah. She's your wife. But you do kind of wish that you could just sort of drop in or have the confidence and the ego just to be like, what's going on? What happened? Bye. Yeah. Another one that we were texting a lot about as we were both rereading this, and which is the most upsetting and problematic parts of the book. If someone wanted to make the argument for this book kind of falling out of the pop culture canon, the argument they would make is the treatment and fate of Penny Hardwick.
For sure. It's a very tough reread.
So do you want to go through Penny?
So what happens with Penny is when they go out, they're 16, 17, when they're going, 16.
Yeah.
And the language he uses around Penny, he never really saw Penny as a person, I think.
Yeah.
She was always just a pair of breasts that he wanted to touch.
Yeah.
He just says she's very nice. That's kind of all we get of Penny's personality from when they're going out.
And at the beginning he says, she had nice hair, nice qualities. Her top five favorite recording artists were Carly Simon, Joni Mitchell. Nice girl choices. And that's brilliant the way he does that. And she probably ended up, you know, doing pretty well for herself. But I wasn't interested in any of Penny's nice qualities, because I just wanted her breasts when I was 16.
Yeah. So they break up. He breaks up with her because nothing ever goes anywhere, quotation marks.
Yeah.
And then his friend walks into, well, not a friend, a guy in his class who's a dickhead walks into his class.
Yeah.
Like 3 days later and says, I just had sex with your ex.
Yeah.
So when he goes back to meet her,
25 years later,
and he starts talking about all this, she tells him that she was raped.
Yeah.
And he is just completely self-centered and callous about it.
I'm gonna find that passage, because I think we owe Penny that.
Yeah.
What's very sad about it is she says she wasn't raped, but she was.
Yeah. She said, it's not rape because I said okay, but it wasn't far off. I think that could be just a quote in the film, but it's very similar in the book.
So they're having this nice time. He's incredibly, she's done really well for herself.
Yeah.
Like, she's a BBC journalist, and she takes him to see a movie, and she's got a little flashlight pen, and she's jotting down notes.
Which annoys him.
Which annoys him.
I think that's so cool.
It's very
I'd love to know someone with a flashlight pen.
And he says this kind of snide remarks about how she's put on a lot of weight and she's wearing kind of a big floral dress and she looks a bit mumsy-ish. And he's a bit like, oh, God. Even though, like, she's obviously doing incredible, she seems like a really good laugh. And it's like, well, fuck you, Rob.
Yeah.
And so then they're in the middle of this meal and he's a bit like, so, why did you dump me? And she was like, well, you dumped me. Mm. And he's like, yeah, but then you shagged Chris Thompson, but you didn't want to shag me. What was the deal? What was wrong with me? And he's all, la, 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 my social experiment I'm doing with myself. And then she just gets really upset, calls him a bastard and says this. And she tells me with great force, with venom, frankly speaking, about what she remembers, that she was mad about me, that she wanted to sleep with me one day, but not when she was 16. And that when I packed her in, when you packed me in, she repeats furiously, because I was, to use your charming expression, tight. I cried and I cried and I hated you. And then that little shitbag asked me out and I was too tired to fight him off. And it wasn't rape because I said okay, but it wasn't far off. And I didn't have sex with anyone else until after university because I hated it so much. And now you want to have a chat with me about rejection. Well, fuck you, Rob. So that's another one I have to worry about. I should have done this years ago.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's really horrible.
It's really horrible.
Yeah.
And in the film in particular, it's played, like, it's basically verbatim in the film.
Yeah.
And it's, like, played for such laughs. So, like, this woman is having this breakdown of, like, oh, my God, the person who, like, ruined my relationship with sex for most of my 20s is asking me about rejection.
Yeah.
And the actress who plays it, I have no idea who she is, but she does it really well. And then it's like, oh, wow, I don't have to worry about it. And I hate it, but at the same time, I'm glad it's there because I think... You know, I think a lot of men's relationship with the word rape is that it is something that is thrown around to offend them, you know, and not something that real women experience at least once in the, not like, I mean, most women experience some form of sexual assault in their lives. And I don't know, it's this weird, do you know the Kate McKinnon joke? It's a bit of a sideline, but there's an SNL character she plays called Debette Goldrey, where it's always that she plays this very old, aging film actress who's on like a panel with Emma Stone and Marion Cotillard.
I haven't seen that.
And they do this thing with her where they're like, we hear in Hollywood that there's a whisper network between actresses in order to warn them about troublesome men. And Debette, who's kind of senile and has a cane and big glasses, like, oh yes, back in the day, we used to have a whisper network. We used to say, he raped me, and the men's eyes would just glaze over. And that's what it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely there wasn't like the mainstream language around what is and isn't rape and sexual assault and stuff now that there was in 2000, and there definitely wasn't in 1995. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't excuse anything that Rob does.
No.
But you can see why someone adapting it might have glossed over. They might have went, that's a funny part, and not went, hang on a sec. You know? Yeah. Because it is weird that it made it all the way into the film as well.
Yeah.
But it was 2000 where just people didn't necessarily... Like, if you listen back to even stuff from like 2008, rape 2000,
was invented 18 months ago. So.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But if you listen back to like even like comedy from like 2008, 2009, there's all kinds of language that would not fly at all now.
Yeah.
It's just hard. It's very hard now to get back to liking Rob after that scene once you get to it.
Yeah.
Like, I literally like exhaled loudly when I got to that bit. I was like, fucking hell.
And Rob. The fact that he never revisits Penny ever again.
Yeah.
Yeah, he never thinks about it. He never like... It's this weird thing where the whole... Rob's whole journey, he's like, he wants to be a Bruce Springsteen song. He wants to go back to his old loves, wish them well, and then bid them adieu. But he actually... is not interested in any of their emotional realities, and he's not interested in taking responsibility for his part in anything.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Like, he owes Penny a huge apology.
Yeah.
And he also gets super angry at Laura when she says that she slept with Ray, but the night after he slept with Marie DeSalle.
Yeah.
Like, he is a total hypocrite.
Yeah.
It's I suppose it's kind of a testament to Cormier that we still even consider him as a likable enough man.
Yeah, really is a testament to Cormier. Yeah, he can make you like anybody.
Yeah.
What I really like about Hornby as well is that he has said in interviews a lot that he's like completely over writing about like sad white men in their 30s who can't get a girlfriend or whatever. And it definitely shows, like, he's done some amazing, like, he adapted An Education, he adapted Wild, he's written
Brooklyn as well.
Brooklyn as well. And he wrote a great book called Funny Girl, which I don't think got the press that it
needs. I haven't read that one yet, actually. Yeah.
It's great. It's about an actress in the 60s making her way through the British comedy scene kind of thing.
I'll tell you something. I've kind of stopped saying I like Nick Hornby for a while.
Why?
A few years ago. I kind of got embarrassed about how completely middle brow he is. He's middle browest author.
Yeah.
And as I started hanging around the authors and stuff and kind of making sure I read lots of Booker Prize books every year, mm-hmm. I kind of got a little bit embarrassed about how much I liked him.
Yeah.
So I kind of didn't come back to him for a long time, I think.
Yeah.
And it's only come back to him now. I'm going to buy Funny Girl. I'm going to reread Juliet Naked and About a Boy. And I did get a little bit embarrassed about, because I'm now totally comfortable that I am the most middle-brow man in existence. I'm completely middle-brow.
You are Mr. Arcade Fire.
I don't watch reality TV, and not because I judge it, I'm not interested in it, and I'm also will never go to an opera. You know, I'm just completely,
oh my god, that is the middle.
I'm just totally in the middle, you know.
Wow.
I went to the ballet and enjoyed it, but I will also never go to another ballet probably. I've seen a ballet now, you know. So yeah.
You're Rob.
I kind of am, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm I guess if you were writing Rob now in 2019, he would basically be me, I think. Yeah. Oh,
wow.
Yeah, because I definitely, if you put down my opinions and my knowledge of things in 1995, when I was 11, it wouldn't be, or even into 2000, it wouldn't be far off where Rob is, even though he was 16 years older than me at the time. But mm-hmm. still, I think Nick Hornby men are... I got them at the right time, I think, because definitely having someone who is as bad a relationship as Rob is come into my life when I'm 18 is a very instructive way to learn about things. And then again, to have the guy from Juliet Naked come into my life when I was 24 and kind of go, this is how you talk about music to people sometimes. You know that, right? And I'm not going to do that ever again.
Yeah.
I'm going to let people out there. I'm still a comedy snob. That's not going to go away.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. If you watch Big Bang Theory, I'm sorry. I am. I just can't. But for music, I can see the value in most things now. So
what I like about Hornby, and I think actually when I started writing my first book, when I was talking to editors and my agent about it, I was like, I want to do a Nick Hornby book. And it turned out to not be a Nick Hornby book because you can't be the same as anybody else. Mm. But I was definitely, my first draft of my first book was all there was lists all the time.
Oh yeah.
There was oh, here are my top two reasons for thing. Here's my top four reasons for this. And having breaks from the prose to do here's a blog. And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That meant a lot to me. But what I love about, what I think I've ingested the most about Nick Hornby more than anything else is that he never lets anybody off the hook. Mm. I think men can look at Rob and be like, oh God, I'm seeing some really uncomfortable things about myself in here. But I look at characters in Nick Hornby's work and I'm like, oh, that's something really uncomfortable about myself that I've never quite ingested before. And particularly, and I realize there's a kind of an egotism to me saying this, even though it's sort of self-flagellating, but there's some passages with how he describes Charlie when he meets her in later life that I'm like, oh my God, that's how I act in front of people.
Really?
It's really terrible. And I think I'm going to find it now. And I think, I'm sorry, I'm doing a lot of reading, but I just love this book so much.
I had a load of things highlighted, but then I bought cheap stickers from deals and they all fell out. So I did have some.
Alan, you got to have brand name adhesives.
I know. It's a major oversight on my part. When I go on a book podcast again, I will buy proper post-its.
Yeah. Brand name adhesive always. Yeah. So the thing with Charlie, and she's definitely the most memorable girlfriend of the book and in his life. And he talks about some people never got over Vietnam or the night their band opened for Nirvana. And I never got over Charlie.
Yeah.
And and I'm not saying that she reminds me of me because men are pining out there. But she's invited to a dinner. He's invited to a dinner party at Charlie's house in the present day. And he gets there and everyone works in books and publishing and the media, which is...
Yep.
A party at my house, unfortunately. And everyone's having these very sort of arch and self-consciously clever conversations about I named my dog after Ziggy Stardust. It's all so bristlingly pretentious and everyone's so pleased with themselves and everyone's so ethical but also talking about their most recent ski trip. And I'm not saying those are the conversations I have at my house, but I've definitely been in those circles enough times.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you're like, people don't talk like Gilmore Girls. Then you meet people who do, and you're like, I don't want to be around these people at all.
Yeah, well, yeah. I have a lot of people in my life who do talk like Gilmore Girls, you know what I mean? And I remember that being a sort of a... I remember Gavin, when we first started going out and I started taking him to places with friends and stuff, and he was being like, he wasn't being cruel, but he was like, a lot of your friends just seem to like, they talk as if they're trying to write a script about their own lives. And I was like, well, at that point we were all 24. I was like, well, most of them are.
Yeah.
Anyway, it doesn't help that Charlie talks bollocks all night. She doesn't listen to anyone. She tries too hard to go off at obtuse angles. She puts on all sorts of unrecognizable and inappropriate accents. I would like to say that these are all new mannerisms, but they're not. They were there before years ago. The not listening I once mistook for strength of character. The obtuseness I misread as mystery. The accents I saw as glamour and drama. How had I managed to edit all this out in the intervening years? How had I managed to turn her into the answer to all world's problems? I just felt so attacked.
Really?
Again, it sounds really egotistical, but like, I know that I can put on this thing where I'll put on like a pair of harem pants and heels and be like, oh darling, you must come in. We're all talking about whether we'd have whether we're Proust or Bukowski. But not that, but you know what I'm saying? I know I'm capable of incredible literary posturing and pretension, mm-hmm. and oh la la tra la la, because I've lived in London for almost 10 years, you know, and I don't know what to do with it. And that's why they like about Hornby, like, nobody gets off the hook. Everybody has to have an uncomfortable experience with these incredibly commercial middle brow books, you know.
Yeah, it's, I mean, everybody has that person in their life. You're obviously that person in a lot of people's lives, I guess. Are we going to cast the new film?
Is there a new film?
No.
Oh, Jesus God. You can't just say a thing like that.
Oh, no, it's just because on some of the early episodes you used to like...
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Let's cast the new movie.
Okay.
I think the movie is completely perfect and never should be renamed.
Oh, yeah. But yeah. If you moved it back to like Britain and Ireland.
Mm. Ooh.
Because I was talking about this with Carol Ann and she came up with the perfect new Rob.
Who?
Donald Gleeson.
Very good.
You just want him talking to a camera to you.
Yeah.
And he plays those characters who seem like really nice guys but are totally flawed, like in Frank and stuff.
Mm, that's very good. Donald Gleeson.
Perfect, I think. Yeah.
Who would be the new Dick and Barry?
Okay, so...
Oh, inevitably Barry would end up being James Corden and he would just chew the fucking scenery.
Exactly. I said basically anybody but Corden. I think Nick Helm would be good.
Who's that again?
From Uncle. He is also, he's basically like a British Jack Black. He looks like me, but he does like parody rock songs.
Yeah.
But an uncle, he's like quite really sensitive. He's like a sensitive, toned down version of himself.
Oh, okay.
He's really good. Or weird turn, James Acaster as Barry.
Oh, I think he looks too similar to Donald Gleeson.
That's the problem.
It would be confusing for international viewing.
Dick is hard because it's hard to find, because Todd Luiso is brilliant in that. It's such an understated. He does so many little things in that role.
He's such a quiet, soft-spoken. He's very lovable in that.
Yeah.
Who's a nice sort of softly spoken little boy?
The only person I could think of was, you know, Killing Eve.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you haven't seen it? Yeah. Okay, there's a guy in that. So anybody who's watched Killing Eve will know. Mm. The tech guy who's Fiona Shaw's son.
Oh.
Possibly him, if you shaved his head. Maybe. Because he's a nice boy. Maybe like Ben Whishaw or someone? Too hot?
Yeah,
too hot.
Too obviously.
It's hard to find someone.
It would be nice, actually, if in a newer version, not only if it were, you know, less white, but if... Because I would love to see how that sort of record shop dynamic... Because I sort of associate record shops now on the same way I associate sort of vintage clothes shops and kind of secondhand stores, in that they're kind of very unique places for like queer people to sell like zines and t-shirts.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what has the record shop atmosphere become since the 90s? Like, is it still a super white place where lonely men just drift through things, or is it more likely to be like, could a record shop survive in North London that way anymore?
It's weird. You know what? Most people I know who like buy vinyl, I think, definitely that, like, you see their record players on Instagram are women.
Mm. Yeah, same. Yeah, I was thinking that too.
Which is weird. I think so. That is definitely a different thing.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So one person we haven't spoken about yet much is Laura.
Yes.
Who you were texting while you were reading it, saying that you kind of fell in love with Laura all over again.
Yeah, because you don't see her until the last 50 pages of the book.
Mm.
The book basically starts with the door closing behind her, essentially. So when she's back in his life, it's like, Laura's really funny.
Yeah.
And she sees through him completely, but in an affectionate way.
Yeah.
And there's a bit in the film where he describes the five things he misses about Laura, which he doesn't do in the book.
Yeah.
And it's a nice moment where he like describes like her humor, which is cutting but affectionate and dry and stuff. Mm-hmm. There's a lovely bit in the book where at the very start, you know, he thinks he's okay with it all.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying he might like get a stencil of like chess records put up on the wall.
Yeah.
And then they're back together and she's like, how long did it take you to think about getting a chess record stencil on the wall?
Yeah.
And she's like, I know you. And that's, Caroline does that to me all the time. Yeah. She'll go, you were going to do this, weren't you? I was like, I was, yeah.
It was infuriating and very lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I find her really, like, really funny. I'm not sure the actress in the film captures her brilliantly.
Yeah, her fringe is very distracting.
It is. Those fringes have associations now in 2019 that they didn't have in 2000.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but the book Laura I loved. I actually thought she was, like, a great, great character. Yeah.
I think what's... one of those things about the book that I... No, wait. One of those things that when I read it when I was a teenager that I kind of rejected, but I now understand it, is that when he's talking about missing Laura and he's like, it never made me anxious, but it never made me ecstatic either. And I never spent all night worrying about her, but I never... basically there were no drastic highs and no cutting lows, but it was just really nice. And he was like, it sounds boring, but it wasn't.
Mm.
And I remember as a teenager having incredibly dramatic relationships with people, thinking that it did sound boring. And now having spent, 5 years in a monogamous relationship with the same person, I understand the value of that niceness, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's brilliant. It's not, I was going to say easy, but it's not easy. It's just... good.
Yeah.
And it's like, sometimes it's a little bit bad, but it's mostly good. Good to great, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't even know what that ecstatic thing really is. It's like, it's so short-lived, you know? It's nothing to build a life around.
Yeah.
You can't, like, if you lived at that, like...
Marriage counselor Alan
It's
now.
Like the hippos from Animaniacs. You know, they're always like, mon ami, oh my beautiful hippo, you know? So that, live your life at that level, you can't, you know? Just kissing each other's hands every day.
Oh my
God. Like, no, just make each other a cup of tea.
Yeah. I mean, my version of the hippos is Gomez and Morticia from the Addams Family. And I do find myself slightly disappointed that real life isn't like that.
See, if you were but I think you want to be Morticia.
Mm.
You don't want it to, or no, you want like the attention Morticia gets from Gomez. You don't want to put in that amount of effort all the time.
No, that's very true. I just want to be worshipped.
Give that back as well, you know?
It's so true, and like the way that they get back together is this really haunting scene where her dad has just died, and she's so overwhelmed by the grief of it. And Rob comes to the funeral, and she says, "I'm too tired not to be with you." If my dad hadn't just died, if I wasn't so cut up, if this, I would tell you to go fuck off. But at present, I sort of need the comfort of being with someone who loves me, which is a really weird kind of like, wow, that's sort of upsetting and anticlimactic. But then they get back together and it just slowly, they slowly get back to an equilibrium in a way that's very realistic to how people get back together, you know?
Yeah, because I think she says, I thought it would just be like one thread if I left that would be the thread. But we're in each other's lives in so many ways.
Yeah.
That it's just, there's so many threads to cut. I just can't. There's too many threads.
Yeah.
It would require so much starting over to fully leave you. It's not worth it.
Not worth it. It's
it's really stuck with me over the years. It's a really, I don't think there's anything like it in terms of reconciliation scene anywhere else that I've read. That's as...
And it's kind of haunting, so bleak, isn't it? Yeah.
It's bleak, yeah. But also... No, it's just bleak, yeah.
Then the chapter kind of ends there, and it's like, and so she moved back in or whatever. And then it just, the next chapter is just five conversations.
Yeah.
And it's like them, just like little fragments of them having these very cute little things. And we just slowly see over the course of this next chapter that they are slowly working their way back to a position of trust.
They're not pretending it didn't happen.
Yeah.
As well, which I think is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, I think if there were a couple who were breaking down and then decided to get back together or whatever, I think that is actually a really valuable part. It's like, it doesn't get better immediately. They just learn to find it funny, and they learn new ways to talk about it, and and then interestingly, in the last sort of 10 pages, this girl who comes to interview Rob, called Caroline, another bitchy Caroline in literature, comes in, and he sort of fixates on her. And then he sort of starts making tapes for her, and that's when we know it's all about to go wrong. And we're like, no, Rob, you just got things back to an equilibrium with Laura. And then he just sort of abandons it, and he's like, oh, I'm sick of it. He's a bit like Laura, realizing she's too tired not to be with Rob. Yeah. Rob is too tired to like keep doing this endless thing of fantasizing about these random women he knows, making them tapes, wooing them with music, and then 5 years later it breaking apart. And it's I don't know, it's like this weird last minute thing.
Yeah, I mean, this is... I guess with most of the books you cover on here, there's kind of like a final getting together moment. Isn't there generally like, or some kind of...
Yeah, I guess there is, yeah.
Whereas this, it just kind of...
They drift
flows.
Together.
They just kind of they kind of drift on. And I guess it's more of a lived-in kind of relationship.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm glad he stopped doing that. Yeah. I guess he's the kind of person who he's only now realizing that just because you're in a relationship doesn't mean you like stop thinking people are attractive.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you have to do anything about it. And I get the main thing I took from this, and it's kind of always stuck with me, is that the thing you have with a person isn't just like your immediate level of attraction to them. It's that plus everything you've built up together.
Yeah.
So for someone new to be able to replace all of that, it can't happen. Whereas Rob was always just focusing on that one bit and kind of forgetting about all the other stuff around it that makes what he had special. He kind of only starts to value that at the end, I guess, which is what the underwear conversation is about, where he's like, I always like just imagine being surrounded by like fancy women's underwear and radiators, but surrounded by fancy women's underwear, and now I see like
grey Marks and Spencer's
cotton stuff on radiators everywhere, and it's like, but everybody has that. I have to accept that there will never be a woman who doesn't have that, and I keep on imagining there's going to be a woman that does, and it's not. So, and I think most people should accept that.
It's very simplistic, but I think also a thing people need to hear, you know? Because there are people who can't deal with the initial glow going away, and they'll just keep on, they'll keep trying to trade up so they can have that magical romantic first year with someone, and then they'll dump them, and then like, oh, I've met the new love of my life, and you'll have to keep sort of watching them go through this. We should probably finish up.
Probably.
So, Alan, thank you so much for coming on Sentimental Garbage.
Thank you for having me.
Our first Dublin episode.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely delighted. I love this podcast. I'm delighted to be asked.
And I love you.
Aww.
You host a podcast called Juvenalia.
I do.
Tell us a little about that.
So Juvenalia is a podcast where we get a guest on and they pick a bit of pop culture that was really important to them when they were young. And then they tell us about it and anything else that jumps off of that topic for them. Caroline has been on the show...
Four times.
Twice as a guest, twice as a host.
Yes, that's true. The fifth Beatle.
She is our fifth Beatle. So I am delighted to be able to come back to go onto your podcast for once. So it's good.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a delight. Thanks for listening to Sentimental Garbage. This podcast was produced by me, Karen O'Donoghue, courtesy of Tall Tale Studio in Dublin. If you want to get in touch with me about the podcast, you can do so at zaralineodonoghue@gmail.com. This episode was brought to you by The Croke Park, modern luxury in the heart of Dublin City. Visit doylecollection.com/hotels, The Croke Park Hotel, to plan your perfect weekend city break. Bye!